The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Newt's World, my guest and my very good personal friend is Herman Pirchner. He is the founding president of the American Foreign Policy Council, a nonprofit public policy organization headquartered in Washington, D.C. His travels have taken him to most areas of the world, including more than 65 trips to the former Soviet Union since 1989, and more than 30 trips to China since 1994. And Calista and I have had the pleasure and honor of traveling with him in both Russia and China, and he is remarkably knowledgeable. And in particular, he has been writing consistently for over a decade about Putin and the nature of Putin's Russia. So I'm really pleased to welcome back my guest, Herman Pirchner. He last joined me to talk about his book, which is very relevant at this moment, Post-Putin Succession, Stability, and Russia's Future. And I wanted to have him on again as we mark the second anniversary of the war in Ukraine. Herman, welcome, and thank you for joining me again on Newt's World.
Thanks, Newt, for having me on. It's always a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, and I have to say, I was just citing an earlier book of yours about great Russian geographic expansion, which I think is about 2014, and it's amazing. You're very prescient, I think, because you go back to the historic nature of Russia, and you don't seem to be particularly swayed by temporary things. So let me start there with your sense of what Putin really wants and what really motivates him.
Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, was asked who Putin's great advisors are on Ukraine and this war. And his answer was Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great. Why? Because these are the three leaders from Moscow that expanded the territory of Russia. Russia, under the time of Ivan the Terrible, was a little city-state of Moscow and expanded to 11 time zones. And they measured their greatness by how much land they could take. When they were strong, they took land. When they needed to recharge their batteries or had a temporary defeat, they paused, signed a peace. When they're stronger, they'd attack again. And this is his modus operandi, thinking about grabbing Abkhazia and Ossetia de facto right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, as well as Transnistria, thinking invasion of Georgia 2008, the first invasion of Ukraine 2014, and now back again in 2022 for this intense war that's been going on for 2 years.
I'm really curious, even though Putin was a trained senior KGB officer with all of the implications of that, both in terms of psychology and ideology and attitude towards killing people. In your mind, is Putin more a great Russian nationalist or somebody who aspires for the Soviet Union, or are the two synonymous?
I think the two are largely synonymous, but there's also another factor. It's about staying in power. If Putin cannot show victory, however he's able to sell it to the Russian people, he's going to be out of power and likely dead. I think when he went into Crimea in 2014, it was in part because he was having internal difficulties. And this was viewed as a great victory inside of Russia, where it was generally popular. I think going into Ukraine this time, he thought he would have an easy victory and would buy him more breathing room in Moscow among some people that were less than totally happy.
The American chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, said at the time that he expected Russian forces to be in Kyiv in 3 days. I suspect if Putin's generals had a similar attitude, this whole war must be an enormous shock at one level.
Well, I think that's true. This misjudgment on the part of the Russians is a result of the system that Putin set up. For instance, he would say, General Gingrich, here is X number of hundreds of millions of dollars to refurbish the tanks, and you put half in your pocket, and you give a nice coat of paint to the tanks and send a good report, and that half that you put in your pocket starts to go up like an Amway contract, some of it resting with Putin. So he was told he had an army that was stronger than it was, and he spent a lot of money inside of Ukraine for people to prepare the welcome. So they took the money. They said, Mr. Putin, the people in Ukraine love you, be open arms, the resistance will be token, and give me some more money and I'll make it even better. So I think he was a victim of that. The misjudgment on the American side is different and, to my mind, more serious, because I'm told that we did not have people in Ukraine with a mastery of the Ukrainian or Russian languages, and therefore limited in how widely they could talk and circulate within Ukraine. Anybody that traveled in Ukraine a lot, and I had, understood that the Ukrainian people were willing to fight, absolutely willing to fight. They would tell you, we know a lot of us will die, but we won't surrender the lives of our children and grandchildren to Moscow. And they had a plan. And they had javelins provided, by the way, by Donald Trump that could stop attacks. So I think our failure of intelligence had to do with problems of our intelligence on the ground, our technical means, the intercepts and satellite pictures showing Russia preparing, that turned out to be pretty accurate. But the ability of Ukraine to fight and the inability of Russia to fight, I think, was a massive failure of intelligence and tied in no small part to lack of language capability.
And it strikes me that had we continued Obama's policy of not offering lethal weapons, that in fact Ukraine would have fallen.
Absolutely. The javelins that turned back the tank columns approaching Kiev were decisive, along with other weaponry that came under Trump's rule.
How do you measure where we are right now in terms of just Ukrainian war, to start there?
Well, I just came back from Ukraine. I was there with a bicameral, bipartisan staff delegation that American Foreign Policy put together. This was the tail end of January. And at that point, they were pretty blunt in Kiev that they're already rationing ammunition. There's not enough arms to go around. And if we don't get arms from the U.S., which is the only country that can supply them, we're going to start taking unnecessary casualties and we're going to begin to lose land. And that is happening now as we speak. People say the Ukrainian army should be bigger. It would be bigger if they had enough weapons to give them. But the political problem in Kiev is if we institute a draft and send people to the front with no guns and no ammunition, we won't increase our war fighting capability and we'd have big blowback.
My hunch is in the next few weeks, we'll pass this next tranche of aid and open up the spigots again. I read one piece, which you might comment on, that the Russian armament system has actually been rebuilt. so that they now produce about 30 tanks a month. And the entire current British tank force is 44 tanks. It strikes me that because Russia is such a big country and has so many natural resources, people in the West tend to underestimate the resilience and the capability through brute tactics to generate power in a way that I think Westerners couldn't do, because in part we lack the Russian cultural traditions, and we don't appreciate that they're willing to profoundly shape their standard of living around the needs of the national security system.
Well, I think all that's correct. But before I get into it, a quick thing about aid passing Congress. I think it will too, but we don't have things in the pipeline. And in Kiev, they're expecting a very rough March and April before adequate weapons and ammunition reach the front. So we should be prepared for that and not surprised if there's bad news until weapons get and our ammunition gets where it needs to go. Yes, Russia is building tanks, but the Ukrainians are knocking out more than is being built every week. They're doing it largely with drones, which are reshaping the nature of war, and not just with tanks. One third of the Russians' mighty Black Sea fleet has been wiped out by sea drones. If this continues, they're going to have very difficult time resupplying the troops in the occupied south of Ukraine, as well as in Crimea proper. They are refurbishing tanks from World War II, but some of them are in such bad shape, they're towed to the front and used basically as artillery. And this is one of the reasons I have a minority opinion that time favors Ukraine. If they're properly armed, there will begin to be an internal blowback inside of Russia. Putin survives by saying we can outlast the West, and it's a horrible cost, but as long as we're able to take ground, we'll rest and we'll take more, because everybody will understand the U.S. and the West can't stay the course. They don't have the stomach to compete with us. We'll just be tougher. But if Ukraine has the weapons, takes back some land, fights to stalemate, degrades the capability of Russia to produce and to transport weapons, it may be a time for reevaluation by the Moscow elite, who privately have turned against Putin. Not acting now, they're all afraid to stick their head up, but there'll come a time where it tips.
A couple of things that came up. One is, I saw a piece last week that the F-16s are now beginning to go operational and that they really are a game changer in terms of Ukrainian capabilities. I mean, is that your assessment?
I'm not sure how soon they'll be flying. My best guess is to have significant numbers will be in the summer. But right now, I saw statistics over the last week, and Russia's flying maybe 110, 20 sorties a day. Ukraine, 8 or 10. So the sortie ratio is 10 to 1 in favor of Russia. If that's changed because of F-16s, it'll make a big difference.
The other thing I'd seen that was fascinating is, and I probably got the title wrong, but the bridge that connects Crimea.
Yeah, it's a Kerch bridge. Ukraine has announced it has a capable ability to take it out at a time and place of its choosing. My guess is that will be when they further degrade the naval capability. For instance, in the Azov Sea, using landing craft to bring weapons across the Azov Sea and being used in the Black Sea as well. And there may be as few in the Azov Sea as 2 operational landing ships now, and they're afraid to use them. They're trying to do it undercover. If Ukraine knocks a few more of those out, I think they'll go after the Kerch Bridge, and then Russia has a really big problem of how they maintain a supply chain into Crimea and into the southern part of Ukraine proper.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At the time that Putin took over Crimea, part of the argument was that Khrushchev had made a mistake in giving chunks of Russian land to Ukraine. Partially, I think the argument was that his wife was Ukrainian. But at the time, there was also argued Crimea was overwhelmingly Russian. But I'm curious, having now experienced the Russian state for the last decade, how the sentiment of the people in Crimea would be today, and whether or not, in fact, Putin could win a referendum.
Well, I've been in Crimea, I think, three times before Russia took over in 2014. And I came in knowledgeable in the referendums that have been held. At the time of independence, Ukraine voted about 90% as a country for independence. And that was in eastern Ukraine in the 80s, so overwhelmingly. Crimea was close. I think it was 54, 46 or some number close to that. So there was pro-Russian sentiment there. It primarily was retired military people around Sevastopol and some of the elite that have vacationed there that was a retirement home. It would be the Sarasota or Palm Beach for the Soviet Union. When I traveled in Crimea, though, you would find a large number of Ukrainians. Crimean Tartars, maybe 10% of the population, they absolutely were pro-Ukraine. The demographics have shifted significantly now in that Ukrainians and Tartars have been forced out, some put in jail, and Russians have been moved in to take abandoned or confiscated territory. So the demographics have shifted under the occupation of Russia since 2014. And I would think that may be such that there may be a majority that would be pro-Russian at this point, though it's hard to tell because it hasn't been very pleasant even for the ethnic Russians there, because part of the deal Putin cut when they went in 2014 were the local mafia people, and he gave them power in exchange for helping with the 2014 transition, and they've rode roughshod over a lot of people, Russian and Ukrainian.
Which would also fit the degree to which Putin really heads a kleptocratic state.
Absolutely kleptocratic.
And I think that's a little hard for Americans to fully understand that, in fact, this is a system which survives by fear and by corruption.
Yeah. And, you know, they believe in taking care of the elite and they don't care about the people. Vyacheslav Surkov, who is a longtime top aide to Putin, and really, if there was a Putin brains, it's Surkov, he has written about Putinism. And part of that is that we have an historical destiny to conquer more lands. History demands of us, the chosen people, to conquer more lands. But also he poo-pahs any values of economic life for the people. The measure of state should be how strong your military is, how strong your forces are, and if the people have to live poorly to give you greatness through militarism, so be it. That's the attitude at the top.
Given all that, though, what struck me about the invasion of Ukraine, which I'm sure Putin thought would happen very fast and be over, but because it didn't get over, in a sense, strategically, and I want to get your reaction to this, but it strikes me that the decision of Finland and Sweden to join NATO is an enormous strategic setback for the Russians.
This operates at two levels. At the level you raised, indictment against Putin is very strong. Before he went in, NATO was smaller, less funded, and less unified. Before he went in, Russia had great influence, even dominance of the petroleum and gas markets in Europe. Now that's gone. The political influence that went with it is gone. The Russian army has become weakened enough that you can envision them pulling out of the war, having not the capability to do with civil wars inside of Russia. And remember, Russia is still an empire. You have lots of minorities inside of Russia today that would like to be independent. People in Chechnya and Tatarstan and other places most Americans have not heard of. So the indictment against Putin is strong, but he's hanging on to this idea that if he can outlast the West, if he can gain any territory, he can claim victory. We've taken 20% of Ukraine in the footsteps of my predecessors. We'll get stronger and then we'll take more. He may be able to keep in power doing that. What are the implications for the West? If Putin is seen to be able to take territory from a peaceful country through nuclear intimidation, through the strategic use of war crimes, torture, rapes, murders, through taking kids from Ukrainian families and putting them in Russia, if he's seen to be successful in doing that, then there's no end to it. He will do it again. And what's more, it emboldens the hawks in Beijing, in Tehran, and in other places that are not friends of the United States. That's why if you're in Taiwan or Vietnam, where I've been recently, or South Korea, their national security establishment wants Russia to lose, because if they don't lose, they're all afraid that their enemies will try to do the same thing. If Putin can use nuclear blackmail to take territory, why can't we?
If they actually won, in the sense of Putin, like Hitler in 1940, being able to go into Kyiv and be seen, you know, marching over what he has conquered, the psychological impact, I think, would be far beyond any imagination in the West.
I think had he gotten into Kyiv that quickly, there would be fighting in Poland or the Baltic states now.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Assuming we can get things through the Congress, there's a fairly realistic likelihood we'll have a new and dramatically tougher president in January. And it's clear that the Europeans are gradually, steadily muscling and becoming more engaged. Is the goal to actually fight back to the status quo 3 years ago with the Russians still in eastern Ukraine and Crimea? Or is the goal to actually drive them back to the Russian border? I mean, what would you say strategically the Allies should be trying to do?
We should try to go back to the 2001 borders, which are the borders when the Soviet Union collapsed. Can that be done? I don't know, but we shouldn't give up without trying. And the Europeans have caught on to the fact that Russians' imperial ambitions go beyond Ukraine. This is why now I think we're maybe number 15 in terms of the percent of GNP we give to Ukraine. It's why total aid from Europe now is larger than from the United States. It's why Finland and Sweden have joined NATO. They're scared about further Russian ambitions. So it's costly for us to help, but it's be far more costly if we don't stop Russia now.
I've been looking for years at Kaliningrad. Here you have this enclave between Poland and Lithuania, which I think Putin recently actually visited there. And they clearly have been putting very sophisticated weapons. They have nuclear weapons there. And it strikes me that he clearly, if he could win in Ukraine, he probably would pivot first to the three Baltic states.
Well, that's right. He does not have land access to Kaliningrad now. But the thought was that he would go through part of Poland and maybe the Baltic states as well to give him land access. You know, this was Danzig in World War II. So he wants some equivalent of the Danzig corridor.
That whole notion, plus you can imagine that the Russian-speaking parts of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania will suddenly decide that they're being mistreated precisely like the Sudeten Germans in 1937-38. I mean, this is an old playbook.
It's the battle plan, absolutely.
How do we convince sort of skeptical conservatives that our interest in Putin being defeated is enormous and that secondary considerations can't allow him to win?
I think we need to improve the database of people that don't understand this on the right, and that's going to happen to large measure by travel, to the extent that people can go more than a two-hour photo op in Kiev, but to be there for at least a few days to talk at different levels, and not just in Ukraine, but to go in Germany and Poland and the Baltic states, which are safer and you can stay longer. I think the more knowledgeable our conservative colleagues are, the better the policy will be. I think it's a fact deficit.
Somebody said to me that there's a proposal now in the House that's bipartisan that would provide all the defense aid, but not the economic aid, and would also have several other steps. There's a very serious proposal to confiscate, for example, all of the Russian assets that are outside Russia, which is about $300 billion, and turn it over to Ukraine. So that in effect, the Russian money would be helping fight the Russian attack. But it struck me when I talked to somebody who knows a great deal about the House, they said they thought if this bill gets to the floor, it gets 300 votes.
I'm hearing the 300 vote number in the House for aid to Ukraine. I don't know about the specific bill, but what United States uniquely can do is give them weapons. I think the dollar amount can be picked up either by Europe or through confiscation of Russian assets. And I'm in favor of both.
So. When you're faced with really a two-front competition, Russia on one front, China on the other, and North Korea and Iran as very real threats in the age of nuclear weapons, that we have to have a defense industrial base that is, first of all, dramatically more modern. The point you made, for example, about drones and the remarkable impact they're having. And we have to have a big enough and a modern enough defense industrial base to be able to compete both with China and with Russia simultaneously while blocking Iran and North Korea.
There was a wonderful study done early in the Trump administration on the weakness of our industrial base. That should be dusted off and be part of the discussion.
Have you been mildly pleased by the degree to which the Europeans, in fact, are shifting as they better understand Putin?
Yes. You know, going into Ukraine at the end of January, we stopped in Warsaw. And in conversations there, we were told that the Poles are taking some comfort that the rest of Europe is understanding their arguments, which they've been making for years, about the danger of Russian imperialism. The Poles privately will say that should Ukraine collapse, they're going to have to put several hundred thousand people on the Polish border to prevent a quick land grab by Putin ahead of a frozen war. So the danger is being felt first by the countries that are closest to Russia, but is being felt by Germany and others as well. I think the UK understands it pretty well. I was there a few months ago.
Biden announces 500 additional sanctions. I think we began the sanctions dance with the invasion of Crimea 10 years ago. Do these things really bite? Do they have an effect?
I think it's a good press release. I think it helps marginally, but you can't equate sanctions with HIMARS. I understand there are almost 1,000 HIMARS that we're getting ready to destroy because they're old. But if they were shipped to Ukraine, they would still be usable for a period of a year. Why aren't we doing that?
But that's sort of typical of the whole bureaucratic way we've approached this thing from day one. We have not had an aggressive effort to sort through all of our assets and put them on airplanes, which frankly drives me crazy. The other part of that is, it seems to me, we have to recognize that there are times when hard power is the only thing that works. That if the other guy, as Mao once said, all power comes out of the end of a rifle. So we have to be prepared to win that fight as well as to do all these various diplomatic dances. And I think it's still very hard, not just the American people. The American people probably are psychologically more aware of that, but our establishment seems amazingly averse to dealing with the reality of real power.
I think the Biden administration has been self-deterring with regard to Russia. We've delayed sending weapons 6 months, 8 months. A lot of it has been sent, and some credit is certainly due for sending those weapons. But we don't have a sense of urgency and time. A year ago, I was talking to the National Security Advisor over there. I said, what's the hardest thing you have to explain to Americans? He said, time, time. We needed these things in time.
Right. And this is where Trump is so radically different from Biden, and that Trump has an instinctive sense of the importance of decisive movement quickly, and that you need the shock effect of it being very fast and often surgical. I want to thank you. I'm sure we're going to ask you again in the future to come back and share again. And knowing you, I'm sure you will have been in 10 or 12 countries by the time we do it. Your commitment and, frankly, the American Foreign Policy Council that you founded and have led do an amazing job. I read a lot of your documents. You've assembled a brilliant team of younger analysts, and you have a great program of taking people around the world and trying to get them to learn personally. I really appreciate you taking the time to help us better understand what's at stake and what Putin's strategic threat is to the lives of all of us.
Thank you, Newt. It's great being with you, and we appreciate your kind words very much.
Thank you to my guest, Herman Pirchner. You can learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council on our show page at NewtsWorld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Garnsey Sloan, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.